Welcome to your weekly Constitutional, a radio show about the Constitution, produced in partnership with the home of the Constitution, James Madison's Montpelier. My name is Stuart Harris, and I teach constitutional law at the Appalachian School of Law in beautiful Grundy, Virginia, and I'm speaking to you today from the studios of WETS HD1 and WETS FM in Johnson City, Tennessee. You know, as I've traveled the country and spoken to people and to do this show, I've learned all about different aspects of the Constitution, things that I might never touch upon in the classroom. And I've met lots and lots of interesting people and heard lots of interesting stories. And among the many things I've noticed is that there are a lot of people in this country. I see them everywhere. They're called women. Yep, you heard me right. They are everywhere. But when you study constitutional history, or even American history generally, you might be a little bit less than aware of that, because you see, women's stories have been largely overlooked. And so whenever I come across a story that emphasizes the importance of a woman in constitutional history, I'm instantly interested. And I'm very glad to say that today we have not one, but two such stories. Now, the first one you're going to hear is about a woman named Elizabeth Keckley. Heard that name? Well, you might have heard it if you saw the movie Lincoln, because Elizabeth Keckley makes a cameo appearance or two during that movie. She's always in the company, it seems, of Mary Todd Lincoln, the First Lady, and it's appropriate because Elizabeth Keckley was most famous for being the seamstress to the Washington elite, indeed the seamstress to the White House. What few people realize, though, is that she was much more than that. She was even a friend and a confidant to Mrs. Lincoln, and she wrote a book about her experiences. The second person we're going to hear about is a woman I'm almost certain you've never heard of. Her name is Beata Gordon, and she's an Austrian, and she helped in doing something constitutional that had almost nothing to do with the American Constitution. We'll just leave it at that for now. That's just a little teaser for later. For the moment, though, let's go back and talk about the American. Let's talk about Elizabeth Keckley, and let's speak with a writer by the name of Joan Gage, who knows all about it.
Elizabeth Keckley was a very interesting woman who was born a slave and became the dressmaker to Mary Todd Lincoln, and was on the scene and a confidant to both the Lincolns during the Civil War and after the Civil War. And I became very interested in her in 2007. I didn't even know she existed, but I collect antique photographs. And on eBay, I bought a cased ambrotype, which is like a daguerreotype, and there was an old piece of ID pinned to the velvet inside the case, and it said Elizabeth Keckley, formerly a slave. So naturally, I got onto Google and discovered that this remarkable woman existed. She was even the first person to write a White House backstairs memoir. It was called Behind the Scenes, or 30 Years a Slave and 4 Years in the White House, and it caused a huge scandal, which basically ruined her life and broke up her friendship with Mary Todd Lincoln.
That does sound like a fascinating and overlooked historical person.
Exactly, and she continued to be overlooked until the film Lincoln came out, the Steven Spielberg film, recently. An actress named Gloria Rubin played Elizabeth Keckley in the film, and everybody suddenly discovered her and wanted to know more about her, but the film itself told very little. And one of the reasons, Tony Kushner, the screenwriter for the film, said originally the script was 500 pages long, and he had to cut out a lot of good scenes with Elizabeth Keckley, and he would like in future to write more about her, and I hope he does, because I think her story is of interest to everyone, and especially to women, because she suffered through all sorts of dramas. As I said, I ended up writing a short essay for the New York Times Online, the disunion section, which I think every week or every other day has a short essay having to do with the Civil War.
And right. That's where I first heard about your article and first heard about your research. Well, you're right. It's a fascinating tale, and it's a fascinating overlooked person. So let's start at the beginning, if we can. And why don't you just tell me about Elizabeth Keckley from the beginning?
Elizabeth Keckley was born in 1818 to a slave named Agnes. They were both owned by Armistead and Mary Burwell in Dinwiddie, Virginia. The mother, Agnes, who was called Aggie, was a house slave, which was a privileged position. She had been taught to read, which was illegal at the time, and she taught her daughter, Elizabeth, who was called Lizzie, to read and to sew as well. And in the end, it was Elizabeth's skill at sewing that made it possible for her to buy her freedom and become an emancipated slave and an important dressmaker to the social ladies of Washington, D.C. But I'm getting ahead.
That's all right. But as you point out, it was illegal in many states, including Virginia, to teach slaves to read. How did she learn? How did she get around that law?
Well, I'm assuming, and often the house slaves did learn to read because they would watch the children of the house learn to read and learn right along with them. And I suspect that that's how Aggie learned to read. And then she saw the value of it and taught her daughter as well.
And she also taught her to sew, which, as you pointed out, was very important.
Yeah, which was very helpful.
Mm-hmm.
From the time Elizabeth, Lizzie, was four, she was employed as a house slave nursing the babies of the house. Armistead Burwell, the master, had 11 children. They didn't all live to grow up, but there was a great need for nursemaids in the house. And Elizabeth, she says her earliest memory was being beaten when she was 5 years old. She was dressed in her little apron, and she was supposed to rock the baby, and she rocked the baby so hard that the baby fell out of the crib. So she was beaten, and that made a memory, her earliest memory.
Not a very pleasant way to start out, but I'm afraid probably all too common.
She was quite feisty and rebellious, and as she got older, she had more beatings, but she defied the people who were beating her. Elizabeth Keckley's mother, Agnes, the slave, was actually married to a slave named George Hobbs, who worked on another plantation, and they were only able to see each other twice a year at Christmas and Easter. And then he was sold off far away, never to see his wife and Elizabeth again. But towards the end of her life, Elizabeth's mother told her that her actual father was the master of the plantation, the owner, Armistead Burwell. And this probably was not an amazing revelation to anybody because Elizabeth was very light-skinned and was referred to as a mulatto in those days. And anyway, so her master was her father, and then she was sent to work for other children, so they were all her half-siblings. Everybody she was owned by in her life was either her father or her sibling.
Which is just really poignant and really astonishing to think about, having your own offspring as your slaves.
Mm-hmm.
And yet it was all too common, wasn't it?
Very common. I am not, as I keep saying, I'm not a Civil War expert, but I am an antique photo collector. And when I started collecting, I kept finding slave-related, racial photographs, and it was very, very common for children on a plantation or in a homestead to be the child of the master. And there was some famous quotation. A woman said, all the ladies of the mistresses of the plantation would tell you who fathered that white slave child and who fathered that one, but they pretended like their own in their house dropped out of heaven, you know, and made no mention of where. And the children often looked exactly like the father. And there's a whole series of photographs which are my special interest, but I won't go into them now. I call them white slave children photographs. And the abolitionists went down to New Orleans and photographed a lot of these very white-appearing children and then sold the carte de visite, the CDVs of these, for the purpose of the abolitionist movement and educating the newly freed children. But I digress. Back to Elizabeth Keckley, at age 14, she was sent to live with the newly married Burwell son and her half-brother, Robert Burwell. I believe in North Carolina is where they lived. And he had a wife. Elizabeth writes about this in her book. He had a wife who I guess came from a lower class white family. Anyway, the wife wanted to break Elizabeth's spirit, and she asked a neighbor named William Bingham to beat her, to beat this girl, who I think he started beating her when she was 18, to break her spirit. And he did, and Elizabeth describes how he was a schoolmaster. Mm-hmm. And he showed up one day and called her into a room and said, "Take off your dress. I'm going to beat you." And she said, "No, you're not. I'm a 18-year-old woman, and you have no right to beat me. Only my master can do that." And you know, anyway, he did. He did bind her hands and beat her, and she until she was covered with blood with a stick. Mm. And she determined she would not cry, and she never did. And he did that two more times, and on the third time, he started crying, the man that was beating her, and he said, "I can't do this anymore. I'll never beat anybody again," or something like that. And so then her own master, her brother, her half-brother, gave it a try at beating her, and he couldn't make her cry, and he felt terrible, too, so he stopped. And while she was living with Robert Burwell and his nasty wife, a neighbor, a white neighbor named Alexander Kirkland, as I wrote in the New York Times essay, raped her, and in 1839 she bore a son, which would be her only child, and she named him George, which was the name of her slave father, if you remember. Mm-hmm. But since I wrote that, I realized that's not exactly what happened. According to another Civil War expert that I came across, was that her owner sort of loaned her for 4 years to this neighbor as a concubine. Not that she worked for him, but that she was accessible to him as a concubine. And in reading Elizabeth Keckley's book, Behind the Scenes, or 30 Years a Slave and so forth, she talks about these things that were done to her, but she talks in a wonderful Victorian ladylike voice. And I want to just read the paragraph where she describes this man, what I call raping her, but she doesn't call it that.
Please
okay?
do. Mm-hmm.
She says, "The savage efforts to subdue my pride were not the only thing that brought me suffering and deep mortification during my residence at Hillsborough," that's North Carolina. "I was regarded as fair-looking for one of my race, and for 4 years, a white man, I spare the world his name, had base designs upon me. I do not care to dwell upon this subject, for it is one that is fraught with pain. Suffice it to say that he persecuted me for 4 years, and I became a mother. The child of which he was the father was the only child I ever brought into the world. If my poor boy ever suffered any humiliating pangs on account of birth, he could not blame his mother, for God knows that she did not wish to give him life. He must blame the edicts of that society, which deemed it no crime to undermine the virtue of girls in my then position." So that's her description of how she came to have a son. And naturally, this boy, George, was three-quarters white. So ultimately, when the war began in 1861, and they were at that point living in Washington, D.C. Let's see. In April of 1861, 12 days after the South attacked Fort Sumter and President Lincoln called for volunteer soldiers, Elizabeth's son George left Wilberforce University, where he was a freshman, and entered in the first Missouri Volunteers. It was then illegal for blacks to enlist, but George had no problem passing as a white man. 4 months later, on August 10, he was killed in action at the Battle of Lexington. And I've since learned that other people call that the Battle of Wilson's Creek, but that is correct. That's the day he was killed.
Wow.
So that's the story of her son, George. After she had this child, I'm just trying to find it, she was sent to live with another half-sibling, namely Anne Burwell Garland. So she had met, Anne Burwell had married a man named Hugh Garland, who was a professor, and they had great money troubles. They were in financial straits, and they eventually moved to St. Louis in 1847. I believe that Elizabeth was then almost 30. And there, Elizabeth came to know free blacks and began to dream of freedom, of buying her own freedom. She was basically supporting the family with her sewing of dresses, and they encouraged her to do outside work because they had no money. He was a professor, and he wasn't making any money. So at one point in her memoir, she says something like, for 2.5 years, my needle fed 17 miles or something. That was how many people were living off the money she was making as a dressmaker. Hmm. She went to her owner, Hugh Garland, and she said, I want to buy my freedom for myself and my son. How much do you want for me to buy my freedom? And he wouldn't agree to this. And one time she asked him, and he said, here's a quarter. This will get you across the river, and then just keep on going, and you'll be free. And she said, no, that under the law of the United States, you are my master, you own me, and I want to be free under the law of the United States. I want to buy my freedom. And she eventually... he gave her a sum, which was $1,200, to buy herself and the boy. And she also, at this time, she had met a man, a black man, who named James Keckley, and he wanted to marry her. And he told her he was a free man. And she told him, I will marry you. I will only marry you if I am free. And she raised enough money. It was basically loans from her clients. And she did buy her freedom with $1,200 cash.
Now, that's a lot of money back then.
Yeah, it's a lot of money. And she originally was asking for loans from various men, saying, I'm going to go north and make money as a dressmaker, and I'll pay you all back. And she, and the last man said something like, there were six men, and man number six said, here's $200. But this isn't a loan. I'm giving you this as a gift because I know you'll never come back and you'll never pay me back. And she was so angry at that point. That she just said, you know, she just broke down in tears and said, I won't take the money under these circumstances. Then a woman client of hers heard what was going on, and she said, you know, I owe you money for my dresses. My mother owes you. I'm going to get together enough women to give you the cash. And she did. And Elizabeth did soon pay them all back with the money she made from dressmaking.
It's your weekly Constitutional. I'm Stuart Harris, and I'm speaking with writer Joan Gage about a woman you may never have heard of. Her name was Elizabeth Keckley, and she was more than just Mary Todd Lincoln's dressmaker. After the break, we'll have our constitutional quiz, and then we'll speak some more with Joan Gage. Stay tuned. We're here at James Madison's Montpelier. Now we're not outside anymore. It's still a beautiful spring day, but we are inside at the Visitor Center, sitting in, I guess you'd call this, what, the snack bar?
Or kind
the
of our lunch snack bar area.
Lunch snack, yeah. Which is very nice, incidentally. And we've come across a lovely-looking family, all four members of it, mom, dad, and brother and sister. And we're going to ask him a question in a minute. But first of all, Kelly, hello.
Hello, how
good.
Are you?
Oh, always very good. Do you have a hard question for this lovely family?
I always have a hard question.
Tremendous.
They're still smiling at us, though.
They're still smiling. Well, wait, they haven't heard the question yet. Okay, and who are you all?
I'm Patsy, Lexington, Kentucky.
From Lexington.
JD from Lexington.
I'm David from Lexington.
Rosie from Lexington.
Rosie from Lexington, too. All right, Kelly, what's this hard question?
All right, here we go. The term civic virtue means that the citizens, A, put the common good ahead of their own interests, B, put their own interests ahead of the common good, C, rule themselves, or D, limit the powers of government.
Oh, those are interesting questions. Okay, so we're looking for civic virtue.
Why is that important?
Civic virtue, what are the answer choices again, Kelly?
A, put the common good ahead of their own interests.
What do you think of A?
I think it's A.
Everybody thinks it's A?
We do.
Okay. Even Rosalie? Or is it Rosie?
Rosemary.
Got it. Okay. We got that. Okay. Well, let's go through the others, though. Let's make sure. What's B?
B, put their own interests ahead of the common good.
What do you think of that one?
What do you think, Rosie?
No.
That is very good.
You don't like that one? Why did you like that, Rosie?
I just can tell.
Rosie can just tell. All right. What about C?
C. The term civic virtue means that citizens rule themselves.
What about citizens ruling themselves? Is that civic virtue?
That sounds more like republicanism to me, but...
Ooh, okay. Sounds knowledgeable. Okay.
Nonpartisan
How about
show.
You?
I still think it's A.
Still thinks it's A, okay, because Rosie just knows. Okay, all right, and what about D?
D, civic virtue means that the citizens limit the powers of government.
What about that one?
I'm thinking that's constitutionalism.
Yeah.
So that's something else. It's not civic
something
virtue.
Something else that's not civic virtue.
So you guys going to stick with A?
Uh-huh.
Nothing,
so far,
I can do to convince you to change, huh?
Also, Dad knows a lot about this stuff.
Oh, that's why we're listening to Dad.
Dad is a ringer.
Now, Rosie is the favorite child.
Dad, what do you do that gives you this knowledge?
Dad's starting on a PhD in history, American history, this coming fall.
Okay,
so,
you're disqualified. All right, Dad's a ringer. Did he get it right?
They did get it right.
Hey,
civic virtue means that the common good is put ahead of their own interests.
Cool.
This is a very important constitutional concept. As you know, our framers, including James Madison, were very familiar with ancient history. And that was a concept that's mostly associated with the Roman Republic.
Mm-hmm.
And in fact, George Washington was often considered to be the very embodiment of this concept. So civic virtue is the correct answer, and you got it for exactly the right reasons. And we're going to have to try to avoid these PhD candidates in the future. So here's your hat. Who gets it?
Rosie
gets a hat? No, Rosie. No, they're pointing at each other. I'm going to give it to Rosie. And that's the first brother and sister I've ever seen sharing so eagerly. So
they are very good. We're very proud of them. We've taught them about virtue, so.
They obviously are showing familial virtue here today, so I hope you all enjoy your visit to James Madison.
Thank you for your hospitality. We really enjoyed this trip so far.
Great, thanks.
Thank you.
It's
your
weekly Constitutional. I'm Stuart Harris, and I'm speaking with writer Joan Gage about Elizabeth Keckley, a woman who was born a slave, but who worked very hard and became a prominent seamstress and used the money she earned to purchase her own freedom.
In her memoir, Elizabeth transcribed all the legal papers that had to do with her manumission, I guess is the correct term for
this. Right, yeah, when you emancipate a slave, right.
Anne Garland, this is a woman, you know, the mistress. This is the woman who owned her and also her half-sister. She wrote a paragraph here. It says, "Know all men that I, Ann P. Garland of the county and city of St. Louis, state of Missouri, for and in consideration for the sum of $1,200 to me in hand, paid this day in cash, hereby emancipate my Negro woman Lizzie and her son George. The said Lizzie is known in St. Louis as the wife of James, who is called James Keckley, is of light complexion, about 37 years of age, by trade a dressmaker, and called by those who know her Garland's Lizzie. The said boy, George, is the only child of Lizzie, is about 16 years of age, and is almost white, and called by those who know him Garland's George." So I was just interested in the way she described the boy as almost white. Mm-hmm. And some of the other legal papers refer to Elizabeth as mulatto, which I think was how they were described in that day. Mm-hmm. You know, a light-skinned black was mm-hmm. often called a mulatto. So, Elizabeth...
she's still in St. Louis now, right?
Excuse me?
She's still in St. Louis at this point.
Yeah, but okay. As soon as she paid back the loan, or maybe before, she moved herself and her son to Baltimore. She had a plan to teach other black young women how to make dresses the way she did. She had a special gift for making these elaborate gowns. That scheme didn't work. She didn't make any money. So she took the boy and went on to Washington, D.C., where she became very successful. But I need to deal with what happened to her husband. Her husband,
yeah,
she
what
married
happened to him?
James
yeah.
Keckley.
Okay.
In the house of her owner, you know. And she, it turned out that, first of all, he was not a free man, as he had said he was.
Oh, man.
And secondly, he had a drinking problem.
Oh.
And she was very, you know, she thought he could be put on the straight and narrow, but no, he didn't. So she told him she was going to leave him and take the boy. Oh, here it is. She describes this again in a very Victorian, ladylike way. "I went to work in earnest in a short time, paid every cent that was so kindly advanced by my lady patrons of St. Louis. All this time, my husband was a source of trouble to me and a burden. Too close occupation with my needle had its effects upon my health. And feeling exhausted with work, I determined to make a change. I had a conversation with Mr. Keckley, informed him that since he persisted in dissipation, we must separate, that I was going north, and that I should never live with him again, at least until I had good evidence of his reform." So that's what happened to her husband, but that's where she got her name, and she did never live with him again.
This woman just couldn't buy a break.
Yeah, it did. No, actually, it got a lot better because when she got to Washington, D.C., she became the favored modiste, I guess is how you say it, of Mrs. Jefferson Davis and Mrs. Robert E. Lee.
Hmm.
And Mrs. Jefferson Davis, whose name I believe was Vania or Varnia, I have it here somewhere, well, they had... President Lincoln had just been, you know, elected, and the Lincolns were coming to Washington, and Mrs. Jefferson Davis said to Elizabeth, "We're going to have to go down south because there's going to be a war, and I want you to come with me because the Northerners are not going to treat you well. They don't know how to treat colored people," is what she said.
Hmm.
And she said, "I suspect that after the war starts, my husband will be elected president. The South will win. My husband will be elected president. I will return to Washington as First Lady and live in the White House, and you will work for me. So come south with us." And Elizabeth sort of thought this over a while and then decided not to go south with her. But she did have a big ambition to work for the new First Lady. And one of her socialite clients said, you know, if you will make me a dress real quick by next week, I will get you introduced to the new, you know, First Lady. And that's what happened.
Mrs. Lincoln.
Mrs. Lincoln, Mary mm-hmm. Todd Lincoln. And she actually interviewed, when Elizabeth went to be interviewed, she saw several other dressmakers, all of them were white women, also being interviewed. But she got the job, and she made the first gown for Mary Todd Lincoln. Not the one she wore at the inauguration, but everyone after that was made by Elizabeth Keckley. And she also, Mary Todd Lincoln was very insecure about her manners, her way of dress, because to the ladies, like Mrs. Jefferson Davis, she was a peasant, you know, coming from the Midwest. Mm-hmm. And Elizabeth Keckley was the perfect person to tell her how to dress. Every day, Elizabeth Keckley, or every time she had an important engagement, Elizabeth would come and dress her, do her hair, choose her accessories, tell her how to walk and everything that she wanted to know. And also, Mary Todd Lincoln would often get a nervous crisis and say, I'm not going to go into this party. The president can go alone. And then Elizabeth would calm her down and get her into the party, you know, so forth.
Wow.
So
she became much more than just a dressmaker. Yeah, much more than a dressmaker then.
Yeah, she was. She was. And she...
You mentioned in your piece in the New York Times that Lincoln's comment when he first saw his wife.
Yes.
What was that comment again?
The first time he saw his wife, he came into the room and his wife was wearing the first gown that Elizabeth made for her. And he said something like, oh, my dear, you look charming in that dress. Mrs. Keckley has met with great success. And that's the quotation that the Times chose as the title to my piece, because mm-hmm. when it came out in the last month, in February, Mrs. Keckley has become a great success. There are now, I think, 3 books written about her life and 2 plays off-Broadway about her life. But I'm waiting for the movie. I think she should have a movie.
Well, maybe she will. But she became, I think you also mentioned she became a babysitter?
Yes, yeah, she often stayed with the children. And, you know, when when Mary Todd Lincoln would go into a party, Willie, the youngest child, you know, the Lincolns had, I believe, 3 boys. And at the time, we're talking about the oldest, Robert, was a teenager or an adult. And then there was Tad, and then there was Willie, who died when I think he was 10. And Elizabeth Keckley describes this, you know, in her memoir. She was actually staying with a bit, nursing little Willie, and there was a big important reception, and the boy got sick. I think it was cholera. I can't remember right now what he died of, but right the night of the reception, it was clear that he was quite ill. And Mary Todd Lincoln said, we've got to cancel this reception. And her husband said, no, we've got to go through with it because all these people are coming. And so Elizabeth sat with the boy all night, and I think it was 3 days later he died. And his mother, this is also conveyed in the movie Lincoln, she was so bereaved and so grief-stricken that she took to her bed, wouldn't see the boy's corpse, wouldn't go to the funeral. If she even saw flowers that somebody sent, she would become hysterical. And at one point when Elizabeth was with her, because she stayed with her to console her, the president came in to his wife, and he said to her, and there was a form of this in the movie, he took her to the window, his wife, and he said, And he pointed out the insane asylum, which was in the distance. And he basically said in a very kind way that you've got to get a grip or we're going to be forced to, you know, put you in the asylum over there. And it's ironic because at the end of her life, after the assassination of Lincoln, Mrs. Keckley, Mary Todd Lincoln was institutionalized by her surviving son, Robert.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I'm not going to be critical of any parent who loses a child. It's the most horrible thing a parent can imagine. But I will just point out that Mary Todd Lincoln's reaction to this was so extreme that I think it became an additional burden for her husband, who was, of course, himself grieving.
Yeah, and I think that comes through in the movie,
yeah.
Lincoln. Yeah, and then, of course, when Lincoln was assassinated, and that's very well described in Keckley's memoir, the first person that night in the theater, Mary Todd Lincoln called for Elizabeth to come to her and sent messengers to get her. But the messengers, at the same time, Elizabeth Keckley, and she was living in a boarding house. And she and her neighbors, everybody could see something terrible had happened. Everybody went out in the street. There were crowds. The rumors were that the entire cabinet had been assassinated along with Lincoln. And Elizabeth did not connect with Mary Todd Lincoln until the next morning when Mary Todd Lincoln said, "Why didn't you come to me last night?" But it's because they couldn't find her, basically. And as I said in the piece, Mary Todd Lincoln gave Elizabeth her bloodstained cloak and some other possessions that I think that Lincoln was wearing when he was shot.
Hmm. It's your weekly Constitutional. I'm Stuart Harris, and this is an episode for the ladies. We're talking to writer Joan Gage about Elizabeth Keckley, the seamstress to Mary Todd Lincoln. And in just a few minutes, we're going to speak about another woman whose contribution to constitutional law has been long overlooked. After the break, we'll find out what's happening this week at Montpelier, and then we'll finish our discussion with Joan Gage. Stick around. Kelly Carmichael, what's happening this week at Montpelier?
Well, we are starting to think about schools out for the summer.
Alice Cooper. You're too young to be an Alice Cooper. Are you an Alice Cooper fan?
Well, you know, I think everybody likes that school's out for the summer song.
Everybody's a fan of school being out.
Especially at this time of the year.
All right. So Alice Cooper aside, school will be out roughly this time of year for most kids.
Or almost. I mean, we're thinking about what are we going to do this summer?
What are we going to do this summer?
We are going to send our kids to Montpelier to go get dirty.
To go get this, I'm betting, is
mud camp.
Mud camp. Tell me what.
Well, it's officially called Natural History Day Camp, but really it's called Mud Camp, and it has earned its name for a very good reason.
Well, tell us about it.
Well, June 17th to the 21st, Monday through Friday, and then the following week, June 24th to the 28th, we've got two different week opportunities for rising third and fourth graders and rising fifth and sixth graders, where students get to spend really the ultimate camp experience exploring the outdoors at Montpelier. Exploring the acres, the fields, the stream, hiking, outdoor games, crafts, learning, all in the mud. And I've seen these kids come back when they're done and they are covered head to toe in mud with the biggest smiles on their faces. And really, you know, it's probably, to someone who has to do laundry, it could be a nightmare, but it's worth it.
Do you have a hose at the end?
They do. We do.
I actually, when years ago, when my children were little, there we actually would have them go off to the side of the house before they'd come in, and we'd hose them off. We'd only get about half the dirt off, but
yeah.
At least we had that starting point. That's great. Now, are these day camps or are these
day camp?
Mm-hmm. Okay, so
Monday through Friday day camp, and you can look online to register, but you can also call our main line number 540-672-2728 extension 401.
Okay.
But Montpelier.org will have more information
Montpelier.org.
as well.
And I would simply say that obviously if you live within a 20 or 30 mile radius of Montpelier, this would be most convenient for you. And of course, that includes Charlottesville and lots of other big areas. But even people who might be thinking about doing a vacation around here, and there's lots to see.
Sure.
You could make that part of your vacation. The kid,
absolutely.
The younger kids might want to be here while mom and dad go off and visit a winery, a vineyard or something.
It sounds like good camps for everybody.
It sounds like for everyone. Okay, thanks very much,
Thank
Kelly.
Thank you.
It's your Weekly Constitutional. I'm Stuart Harris. And now let's finish our conversation about Elizabeth Keckley with writer Joan Gage.
To tell the rest of the Keckley story, also, while Willie was ill and Elizabeth was nursing him, this was the same time that she learned her own son had died in one of the early battles of
right.
the Civil War. And she writes about that. She actually devotes one paragraph to that, the death of her son, and many, many pages to the death of Willie. But, of course, she knew her readers wanted to know more about the Lincolns. And she tells a lot of interesting things, including some funny remark that Lincoln made about when he saw his wife in one of the gowns, and he was trying to say, that's too low cut for you. But he said something like, oh, that gown has a lovely tail or something, meaning the train, but it would be good if there was more on top, you know, and less on the bottom to cover up her chest. But she was very proud of her décolletage, Mary Todd Lincoln. So Lincoln was assassinated. Mrs. Lincoln went back to Chicago and took Elizabeth with her because she couldn't cope. I mean, she was totally distraught. And so Elizabeth Keckley traveled with her and stayed with her in Chicago for 3 weeks, but then she said, I have to go back to Washington because I have all these clients, I have all these gowns I have to make. And there was a correspondence, I don't know how long it did, about 2 or 3 years, where Mary Todd Lincoln kept begging Elizabeth to come back to Chicago and live with her, and she became paranoid a little bit, Mrs. Lincoln, and she felt she was out of money and had no, she was totally out of money, in her opinion. And she they made up a scheme that she would come to New York under an assumed name, and Elizabeth would meet her in New York, and they would together sell Lincoln's clothes, her own gowns, and possessions of the dead president. And that's what they tried to do. And in her memoir, Elizabeth Keckley tells how when they went to New York under false names, or under Mrs. Lincoln's false name, and tried to stay in a hotel, the hotel wouldn't let, even though this was after the Emancipation Proclamation, they couldn't get a room for Elizabeth because she was not white.
Right,
but
anyway,
the scheme to make money for Mrs. Lincoln by selling the president's possessions leaked out to the newspapers and became, it was called the old clothes scandal. Everybody thought it was outrageous that the former first lady was trying to sell the president's possessions to raise money. So Mrs. Lincoln went back to Chicago. Elizabeth went back to Washington, D.C., but she wrote her memoir, which I have previously mentioned, Behind the Scenes, or 30 Years a Slave and 4 Years in the White House. And she wrote it, she said, with the intention of explaining the First Lady's actions and defending the First Lady. And, but when the book was published, and I believe it was in 3 years after the assassination, so it would be 1867, it was a huge, everybody denounced it. The New York Times denounced it, and Robert Lincoln, the surviving son, denounced it, and it was even withdrawn from the bookstores because it was considered outrageous that the privacy of the Lincolns was being exposed this way. Mrs. Lincoln broke off the friendship, and they were never together again. They were never reconciled, I believe. And also, in the appendix to the book were 24 letters that Mrs. Lincoln had written to Keckley, including the statement that she considered her my best living friend. So this was all outrageous backstairs gossip. And Keckley lost most of her white lady clients. She continued to earn money by sewing, although her business, you know, was much worse than before.
You know, you have to wonder, Joan, how much of this was the, you know, the usual reaction when someone writes a so-called tell-all memoir.
Well, this, I think, was the first tell-all memoir about the White House,
But one wonders how much of it was just that sort of reaction, which is, you know, is fairly common these days, and how much of it was really sort of racial, you know, that it was outrageous.
Everything, I think, had a racial undercurrent. They were like, somebody wrote in one of the newspapers, now everyone who, you know, has a Negro servant has to be in fear of something like this happening, you know. So definitely it was a racial thing. But Keckley forged ahead. She never gave up. And she, when she was 74, she moved to Ohio to become head of the Department of Sewing and Domestic Sciences at Wilberforce University, which was the university for black students that her son had attended.
Mm-hmm.
She, and then in 1893... during the Columbian World Exposition in Chicago, which was a very big exposition, she organized a dress exhibit. And as I wrote, in her 80s, she returned to Washington, and she ended up living in the National Home for Destitute Colored Women and Children, which had been established in part by herself when she founded the Contraband Relief Association just after the war. I forgot to mention that, but Elizabeth did a lot of good things. One was she, I think, tried to establish a free university for freed blacks. And she did found, with donations from the Lincolns and from other prominent Washingtonians, she founded the Contraband Relief Association to aid freed former slaves who were, you know, destitute and didn't know what to do. And the irony is, of course, she ends up living penniless in the Home for Destitute Colored Women and Children.
Mm.
Society, as I wrote, society had turned on Keckley, but she remained unbroken and free of bitterness. Until her death, she had a photograph of Mrs. Lincoln on her wall. She died in 1907 at age 89 and was buried in Harmony Cemetery in Washington. She had been careful to pay far in advance for a plot and a stone. But in the final irony of a life filled with ironies, the graves were moved to a new cemetery, and her unclaimed remains were placed in an unmarked grave and lost to history.
That's unfortunate.
So that is her story.
Wow. Well, that's a compelling story, Joan, and I really thank you for bringing it to people's attention in the New York Times. And
thank you.
Absolutely. Well, I share your hope that this does get made into a movie that gives full expression to this and brings Elizabeth Keckley more to people's attention.
I think that when you have Civil War experts, they're usually men and they're usually concentrating on the battlefield, but Elizabeth Keckley's life and the things that she wrote about that time give a woman's viewpoint and a slave's viewpoint, and I think those are too little known about the Civil War.
I agree with you 100%, but maybe we've struck a little blow to rectify that situation today.
I hope so.
Okay. Well, Joan Gage, thank you very much for being on your weekly Constitutional.
Thank you, Stuart. It was fun. Bye-bye.
Now let's shift our focus, but only slightly. Let's speak with my former student, Joni Burrows, about another woman whose contributions to constitutional history you may never have heard of.
Beate Gordon was actually born in Vienna on October the 25th, 1923.
Mm-hmm.
She was the daughter of Augustine, and noted pianist Leo Sirota. That's her maiden name, Sirota.
Mm-hmm.
And her father was a celebrated concert pianist and actually got asked to come over to Tokyo prior to World War II. So she was...
She's sounding suspiciously like one of these Austrian intellectual European families.
I think that's exactly where we're going.
Okay, that's who she is. Okay, and her dad's over in Tokyo performing?
Yes, he's over there performing. So she is originally educated there at a German school. And once things got, I think the word is too Nazified is the one that I've been coming across. Mm-hmm. She actually was educated at an American school there.
And this is in Tokyo.
In Tokyo. Mm-hmm. And so she was educated there and then came over to California to go to college at Mills College. Mm-hmm. Which is a woman's college, and
you're a product of a woman's college, so you're a big proponent of those, aren't you?
I am. I'm a huge supporter.
Okay.
So she worked there on her bachelor's degree until the beginning of World War II. At that point, with her parents still being in Japan, she was not able to have any contact with them and therefore had no income.
Wait a second. So she literally, they got stuck. I mean, mom and dad are in Tokyo. She's in California. World War II starts. Mm-hmm. It's like the whole Pacific's a battle zone.
Yes, exactly.
Wow, that would really be cut off. And she was just a young woman.
She was. She was in her early 20s at that point. So she actually went and volunteered to, because she was one of the few Caucasians in America at that point that could speak Japanese, given where she grew up.
Oh, yeah.
So she went and worked as a listener and an interpreter and helped with intercepting Japanese messages and things like that. And so she worked through the war that way. And then once it was over, she went and got herself attached with General MacArthur. Well,
before we get that far, I was just curious. Now, she is an Austrian citizen, right?
Yes.
She was from Vienna.
Yes.
Who had been living in Tokyo.
Yes.
And now she's stuck in the United States as a foreign national.
Yes.
But nonetheless, and without mom and dad, she's in her early 20s.
Yes.
She manages to find herself working for the Army, the Defense Department in the United States.
Yes.
That must have taken some doing.
It must have.
All right. Okay. Well, that's admirable. Okay. So she just supporting herself is impressive enough.
Yes.
But doing it in this way and using this unusual language skill she has, very impressive. Okay. So now I'm oriented. So what happens then?
She, at that point, along with MacArthur and the group that goes over to Japan after World War II, she is actually, on Christmas Eve 1945, they go over there, and she is the first woman that is, first, I guess, American national, or however you want to refer to her, the first woman in Japan after the war was over.
Among the occupying forces.
Yes.
I mean, MacArthur goes in to occupy Japan, and she goes with him as part of the staff. Okay.
Yes.
And what was she doing?
She was originally just there. They were there to oversee the writing of the new Constitution, and originally MacArthur didn't really want to be overly involved as an American in the writing of the Constitution of Japan, but I think they had two major flops of constitutions go forward, and then I think at that point MacArthur realized, all right, we need to get a little more involved. So he has this group of people with him, and he challenges those group of people to come up in 7 days with a new constitution for the country of Japan.
In 7 days.
And so... Beate is there, and there are a couple other women there, but she's really the only one that's on this committee. Again, at the ripe old age of 22, they kind of look at her and say, "Hey, you're the only woman sitting in this room. Why don't you go write the female-oriented amendments, the equal rights type stuff?"
So they patted her on the head and said, "You take care of the woman's page."
Yes, exactly.
Okay.
So there's this great story that I keep running across in my research about her, about how she's basically commandeers this Jeep and is driving all over Tokyo trying to get copies of other countries' constitutions. And she's having to go to a library, and she goes, because it's a top secret mission, they don't want the rest of the Japanese people to know that the Americans are writing their constitution for them. So she
sensitive point. Yeah.
Right. So she's having to go to all these different libraries, and she'll check out two novels, one constitution. So nobody is suspicious of what's going on. But she goes through and she reads all of these different countries' constitutions and kind of, I guess, brings all of what she researches together into two separate amendments that she writes. And the First Amendment kind of deals with equality and guaranteeing inequality for women in Japan that just was non-existent prior to her being there and her work on the Constitution. And then the Second Amendment, Article 24, that she works on has to do with marriage and the rights of women in a marriage, so they are no longer treated like property, because from what she saw and experienced as a child in Japan is that women were very much second-class citizens, and she wanted to remedy that. So
So MacArthur saying, probably not anticipating this, simply
right.
says, you know, take care of the part that women care about. And she come back and said, okay, I'm going to take that seriously.
Exactly.
And those were far more, they were far ahead of their time, not just
yes.
in Japan, but in our country, because we didn't apply equal protection to women until 30 years later.
Yes. There's a great quote, or I guess exchange, that I ran across in looking into her life. And really, she did meet a lot of people didn't want this many rights for women in the Japanese Constitution. And somebody, I guess, told her during all of this, well, you've given them more rights than women have in America at this point. And she said, well, that wouldn't be hard to do.
Oh, my goodness. All right.
But she did push through, and those are actually still parts of, you know, the Japanese.
So she was successful.
She was very successful, and I think a large part of it is, I mean, given that it was so controversial, they, you read that a lot of the reason that it got passed is because so many people liked her and believed in her and just her wide-eyed optimism about what needed to be in the Constitution, and they're like, all right, well, Biate says it's good enough.
Talk about being at the right place at the right time.
Right, very fortuitous.
The right person at the right place.
And we have to remember, too, she's not a legal scholar. She's not a lawyer. I couldn't figure out if she actually got her bachelor's degree or not from Mills. I don't think that she did. So, I mean, this pretty ordinary woman is doing something completely extraordinary, which is remarkable.
Well, if you were working for MacArthur and he says, write me up part of the Constitution, I guess you just say, yes, sir.
Yes,
and
sir.
And you seize the opportunity.
Yes.
Well, she passed away recently, which
she
is
did.
What first brought her to my attention, mm-hmm. reading her obituary. What was her later life like? Did she ever get any recognition for this extraordinary contribution?
She eventually did. I believe in the 80s is when she kind of started talking about the fact that, yes, I did, help write this. She did want to keep it a secret because she was afraid that, if it got out that a woman, much less a non-Japanese woman, helped write this Constitution, that it would make it easier for the Japanese people to try and get rid of the Constitution, which she didn't want to happen. Not just because of these amendments, but for other parts of the Constitution that she thought were really important to Japanese culture. But she did, once she got back to America after helping with the Constitution, she played a very vital role in bringing Asian culture into America. She had various positions, I think, with the Asia Society and places like, in groups like that, where she's able to bring over dancers and plays and basically reintroduce America after World War II to Asian culture. And I think that might have been almost her bigger legacy at that point, until people found out about her role in the Constitution.
A remarkable life. So she, just to fill it in, so she came back to the U.S.
Yes.
And apparently became a U.S. citizen, I'm
yes.
guessing. And then I think married someone who was fairly financially well off. And so
yes, he was actually a part of the coalition that went over there to write the Constitution.
Oh, okay, so she met him on the job.
Yes.
Okay, and came back. And so apparently her activity, she was able to apparently raise enough funding to take care
yes.
of these things. Through her connections in the United States, and so she led a very a long and fulfilling life, and at least late in life, she was able to take some credit and be acknowledged. In fact, aren't in Japan to this day,
yes.
don't they acknowledge her and,
yes.
and celebrate her contribution?
They do. She says, you see in a lot of her later interviews, she talks about how remarkable it is that when she goes over to Japan, women want to take their picture with her, and they're so grateful. And I believe that they actually call the Constitution, I'm not sure if it's in general or just those articles, Biate's gift to Japan.
Really?
Yeah, it's pretty incredible.
Well, what a fascinating tale and a very much overlooked contributor to constitutional development.
Yes.
Not necessarily in the United States so much, but in Japan.
Yes.
And thanks very much, Joni Burrows, for telling us all about Biate
Gordon.
Gordon. Okay, I have to remember that name.
Yes.
Thanks.
Thank you.
And that's our show, one for the ladies. Our executive producer is Wayne Winkler. Our distribution engineers are Nick Rosa and Bob Hoffman. Our scheduler is Carol Hutchinson. My name is Stuart Harris. And remember, you are a part of the American experiment.